Thank you again very much for that. And John, thanks for your words for reflection. I thought they were very well put and do coincide quite well with some of what I'll be sharing over the next several minutes. There are certain incidents that have a way of staying with me when they made an impact. I'm sure that's the case with many of you. This one is from a minister's retreat I attended back before I began my ministry here, which is getting further and further back as the years go by. A one session in this gathering called for each of us to share a formative experience that in one way or another shaped our religious and spiritual journeys. One of them was told by a minister who had been able to return to the parish ministry after a struggle with alcoholism that had necessitated his stepping away from it for a time. He passed away a couple of years ago for reasons unrelated to these earlier struggles, which he did manage and had managed to overcome. This colleague of mine recounted how, after numerous attempts to get himself sober and keep himself sober by relying on the power of his will, he found himself once again stretched out on a cot in a detox ward after yet another bottoming out episode. One of his sons had found him passed out at his apartment and had brought him there. And here's what he related. He said, "This time, instead of trying to pull myself together, I just gave up. I decided I had nothing left in me to help me deal with my addiction." And then he went on to say that it was that very act of giving up that turned out to be the beginning of his recovery. What he said was that when he stopped relying strictly upon his own resources and turned to whatever powers that be that were in some sense beyond him, not even knowing what they might be, my one-time colleague recounted that he found the strength he didn't know he had in dealing with his addiction. He went on to become involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and, to the best of my knowledge, maintained his sobriety for the rest of his life. One of the things that strikes me about this story, this incident, as I heard it, I did get to know this fellow better over the years since we first met at that gathering, and I found out that, theologically speaking, he and I are pretty close. Like me, he was a religious humanist who disavows the idea of a supernatural supreme being who can directly intervene in the workings of nature and in human affairs. But the reality of some kind of a power, in some way greater than the self, became very real for him as he went on this journey of recovery. So higher power, deeper power, inner power, these were all terms he came to be comfortable with, even though, like me, he does tread rather lightly with the term God. Well, I thought of this friend and colleague some years after this retreat when our denominational magazine, the Unitarian Universalist World, ran a feature article called 12 Steps, 7 Principles, in which it looked at the role that the recovery movement, which includes and goes well beyond AA, has and does play in the lives of many Unitarian Universalists, a good number of whom kind of tend to fly under the radar on that, but we do have a good number of 12-step people within our wider UU communion as well as this congregation. And while the article did offer a critique of the 12-step higher power approach to dealing with addiction and restructuring one's life, it was largely positive. And this was interesting, because I would imagine there are also a good number of UUs who might be more than a little suspect about a movement calls upon its adherents to recognize their powerlessness and their need to surrender their wills to what they call a higher power. One of the critiques made of Unitarian Universalists is that we have a hard time imagining any kind of a higher power higher than ourselves. Like most slogan-type critiques, that one is partly true and partly unfair. But given, as I said, that some of our fellow UUs do find an affinity between the 12 steps and our liberal approach to religion, I want to take that topic on this morning. I want to focus on three areas. First, I'd like to take a brief look at the origins of the 12-step movement. And then I want to devote some particular attention, this is where I'll be spending most of my time, What I think the terms letting go and higher power might actually mean, because there actually is an interesting dynamic, as I've come to see, between those two. And then finally, I want to end up by asking that we, as I know we are, be a welcoming congregation to people who have found a positive direction for themselves by way of the 12 steps and belief in a higher power, as varied, widely varied, as those particular beliefs might be. I'll interject, first of all, a very personal note. I am fortunate, I consider myself very fortunate, in that I've never had to deal with a life-threatening or life-diminishing addiction of any kind. I guess my fixation on computer solitaire worries me a little bit, but not enough to send me off to any meetings at this point. I also feel very blessed that I was raised in a very safe, secure, if not somewhat overly moralistic, family setting, which, while not perfect, was hardly dysfunctional. So I've not had to seek recovery from either a personal addiction or a painful family past, be it by a 12-step program or any other means. So I really am. I'm an outsider to this movement. And outside, even though we do now have several 12-step groups that use our facility here through the week for their meetings, I've had occasion now and then, just when I happen to be down here, to chat a little bit with some of the people who are involved with it. But as I say, I am really on the outside looking in, and that's the perspective that you're going to get here. But let's take a look at the story, first of all. Any of you here who are involved in Alcoholics Anonymous or any of its various spin-offs, you know this one better than I, which means you can probably do it better justice than I could. We know that most movements, whether they are religious or not, do have some kind of a founding story. Alcoholics Anonymous is no exception. This one is set in Akron, Ohio, in the summer of 1935. A salesman from Vermont who had relocated to New York and who had been through a series of business successes and failures found himself down and out in Akron when a deal he had pinned a lot of hope on fell through. This man, whose name was Bill Wilson, had developed a drinking problem during his career in business, and sometimes he would seek help for that through the teachings of an organization or an outfit called the Oxford Movement. Oxford Movement, to do a little quick hit on that, was an evangelical Christian enterprise established in England, but largely aimed at American college campuses in the early 20th century. It was founded by a man named Mr. Frank Buchman, B-U-C-H-M-A-N. Kind of interesting what he did. He set up shop. He started his organization right next to England's Oxford University, and that was how he came to give the organization the name the Oxford Movement. It really had no ties at all to the esteemed university other than its geographical proximity. I think Mr. Buchman was somehow seeking to bask in the glow and the aura of Oxford, since it was just next door, and giving this thing called the Oxford Movement was to try to give it some sort of a prestige. Well, anyway, this movement stressed the need for the complete surrender of one's life to Jesus Christ, the confession of all wrongdoing, making amends and repentance, and turning oneself over to the guidance of God once that surrender was complete. This organization was the forerunner, actually, of a movement called Campus Crusade for Christ, with which I had some rather interesting dealings back during my campus ministry days. Well, okay, back to Akron, summer of 35. Bill Wilson is about to reach for a bottle when his hoped-for deal falls through, but something stops him and he thinks better of it. Somehow he is able to contact a local minister. And with the help of that local minister, he locates a person in Akron, a physician named Bob Smith, as it turns out, who was also a devotee of the Oxford Movement. You got Bill Wilson and Bob Smith. Doesn't get much more basic than that. Well, Dr. Bob was just coming off a pretty heavy drinking round himself when Bill called him up. The two got together. They found themselves compatible. They hit it off quite well. And they promised each other that each of them, using their own take on these Oxford principles, they would stay in touch and they would help support each other in keeping sober. And from that meeting in Akron, they started a movement. So what became the 12 steps, and what is also known in AA circles as the Big Book, is basically Bill Wilson's reworking of these Oxford principles. He decided to expand them out a little bit. He took them out of their conservative Christian context because he wanted to make them more widely acceptable across a range of religious and cultural lines, and maybe even applicable in secular settings as well. And he applied them specifically to combating alcoholism. Well, that is to say, he de-Christianized the Oxford principles. He took out all of the references to Christ, and he kind of used the terms God and higher power interchangeably throughout them. So anyway, that's the Cliff Notes version of how Bill W. and Dr. Bob started AA. Some of you who are involved in the movement could probably do that much more justice than I can. Well, over the past 70 years, to stay with it for just a little bit longer, this movement has spun off, as already noted, programs to deal with other such addictions like overeating, narcotics, gambling, to name just a few. If we actually were to take this movement and kind of chronicle it, in sort of biblical style, as to what begat what, we could come up with a series of verses that would go a little bit like this. Bill W. and Dr. Bob begat AA, which begat the 12-step higher power movement, which begat the treatment of other self-destructive addictions and compulsions, which begat the treatment of family members affected by such addictions, Al-Anon and the like, which begat the adult child and inner child victims of dysfunctional families recovery movement. Now, by the time you get to that last one, you're sort of, the 12 steps or the higher power may no longer be involved, but the links are still there. So whether or not one considers Alcoholics Anonymous to be a religious movement, I'm not going to argue that one way or the other right now, it clearly did have religious origins. And it has evolved in a variety of ways into a cultural phenomenon that's become a spiritual path for many people and not just a route to recovery. It has indeed become more than deliverance from addiction or psychic pain, and for many people, into a way of life. Well, I'm going to cite just the first three of the 12 steps here. They're the ones I'm going to move into focusing on now. This is just a slightly tweaked version from the original Bill Wilson language. First, we admit we are powerless over alcohol, as later came to be worded, other addictions as well. We have come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. We have made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to a higher power or God as we understand him or it. Well, I can imagine these kinds of things setting off all kinds of alarm bells for religious liberals, to say nothing of secular humanists. The whole notion of being powerless, turning our lives over to a power greater than ourselves, and then looking to him, her, or it to remove our character defects may be a little more than many of us can deal with, I dare say. But I would also say, don't blow it off too quickly. For I find that when I am able to look through the language of the 12 steps, instead of just at it, it takes on a meaning which even I, as a religious humanist, can come to appreciate, even as I do retain some measure of wariness. Maybe the best way for me to get at this is to take what is probably one of the more harsher critiques of the 12-step movement that I have come across, and then I will offer my critique of that critique. Just hang in with me and we'll get there. All right, the critique to which I'm looking at now is a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, Cult or Cure. The title probably gives you the gist of the book. It's written by two very esteemed psychologists, Dr. Charles Bupe and Dr. Albert Ellis. Dr. Ellis is the founder of Rational Emotive Therapy, an approach to psychological treatment, which I know has had a very positive effect upon a number of people's lives. One of the ones I had to study that when I was taking psych courses. The essence of these two gentlemen's argument is that by buying into a 12-step program and affirming a belief in a higher power renders one powerless and devoid of all self-esteem. They can see some value in the 12 steps, some human value. They conclude eventually that AA and its related spin-offs are not a cult, but that's about as much as they will give, before going on to say such things as, it is difficult to see how step one can do anything for those who accept it other than contribute to low self-esteem. Of step two, they say, it promotes the idea of individual helplessness. of step seven, I didn't get to that one a while ago, but it says that you need to seek out people that you have wronged and ask their forgiveness. It says humility is the virtue of those with poor self-images. And so it goes. You get the drift. Well, Dr. Ellis has done some very good work in his field. I know much less about his partner in writing. I would agree with them in principle that following the 12 steps and believing in a higher power has the potential for producing some of the consequences that they describe. But I have to take issue with them also on several points. For openers, to assert that seeking forgiveness is a signal of a poor self-image is rather silly. I dare say we've all had to seek forgiveness now and then for misdeeds that we've done or ways that our behavior or attitudes have been harmful to other people. I fail to see any kind of a diminished self-image in that. But that's not my main issue or issues with these guys. I have to take them on two counts. First of all, it's just that what they're claiming doesn't really square with my own reality. Not a personal reality. I mentioned earlier that I've not had to deal with any kind of addiction, but it doesn't square with the reality of what I have seen and known of people in these programs. And second, there's a paradise. There's a very subtle interplay between being in control on the one hand and letting go on the other, which these two learned gentlemen, for all their knowledge, don't quite seem to be getting and are missing. Go back to that first point. The people that I have known, and some of them are quite close friends of mine, who have used the 12 steps and for whom the concept of a higher power is very real, are anything but helpless zombies in the manners that Dr. Ellis and Buf suggest. To the contrary, they are usually people who have come to feel some sense of personal empowerment and some sense of self-worth after years of feeling no self-esteem and no self-worth at all because of being enslaved to a particular kind of addiction. As for the admittedly heavy-laden God talk in these steps, the 12-step people that I have known, many of them invoke a line from that old song that says, "Take what you need and leave the rest." By this I mean they adapt the language to their own religious, spiritual, or even secular perspectives, rather than just swallowing a bunch of verbiage unquestioningly. For example, an often vocal phrase in 12-step higher power language is "let go and let God." But these words are usually not said or not usually invoked or meditated upon. They're usually not done for the sake of swallowing down some prepackaged notion of God, but rather as a way of helping the person lighten up on themselves a little bit. I recall a conversation with a new member we welcomed here some years ago who had come to Unitarian Universalism by way of the 12 steps. And she told me that for her, the operative word in this "let go, let God" phrase was the expression "let go." And then "let whatever let God may mean take care of itself." Yes, there's a paradox at work here. And I'm one of those people
that does that every once in a while. I'll just talk about it. There's a paradox at work here, and I'm one of those people who believes that most truths that we find, in whatever kind of truth we're searching for, I believe that most truths are actually found in the interplay between a paradox instead of a straight out, it's got to be true or it's got to be false kinds of statements. Which is another way of saying that I prefer paradoxes polemics when it comes to my own search for truth. And this gets me to my second argument with Ellis and Buf, who are polemicists with little apparent appreciation or understanding, as I can tell, for the workings of a paradox. For what they don't seem to be seeing is the paradox, or the interplay, or the interweaving between being in control and letting go, or between personal power and powerlessness. Recall again my late colleague's story that I opened up this sermon with. After relating how he gave up, he went on to say that when he let go of so desperately trying to control himself in his drinking, that he discovered, and who knows from what source, he discovered some kind of a renewed power
he was able to tap into to get his life back in order. Now, neither he nor I could offer a, quote, rational explanation for that. He just knew it was the case, and I believed it. Well, this may not be a rational explanation, but let me play off of that a bit with what I've just said. It seems to me that this 12-step process and this reliance on a higher power, it seems to me what it does is take the immediate weight of whatever a person is struggling with off of his or her back in such a way that the person actually gains some freedom and some power to deal with it. That is the paradox. Once I stop trying so blasted hard to be, as that line from Invictus has it, the master of my fate and the captain of my soul, I can actually find the power to do just that. So call it a higher power, call it God, call it, and this is my preference, call it a deeper power, call it whatever one wishes. The idea is to find a reference point somewhere other than the already overburdened self as a source of strength and trust one can rely on. From my own religious and spiritual perspective, that reference other than the self, or power greater than the self, ultimately proves to be some of the deepest wellsprings of the self. But if you're desperately trying to maintain control on one level of your being or psyche, you can actually be blocking yourself from reaching some of those wellsprings that are at some other level of your being. You have to let go of it on one level, that is, in order to take control on another. And that is the truth that I see beyond the actual language of the 12 steps. Maybe another way of putting this is to say you have to let go of yourself on one level in order to really and truly find yourself on another. And that's my personal translation of the whole let go, let God thing. Well, I want to move to a close now by citing two of our Unitarian Universalist principles that I think come into play on this subject. The seventh one says, we affirm the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. That's not really a theological statement so much as it is a self-evident truth. We are a part of a much larger, interconnected web of life that ultimately sustains and nurtures us. We do not live entirely on the strength of our own will and self-direction, crucial as those things are to meaningful living. I think the message contained in this principle is that we need our connections as much as we need our self-reliance. Our connections to one another, our connections to the earth and its rhythms, our connections to what we know and ultimately believe grounds us, and in which we place our final trust. One of the reasons for being a liberal religious community and a congregation like this one is to offer a place where these kinds of connections are discovered and lived out and celebrated. Perhaps a new variation on the phrase, let go and let God, would be let go and embrace your connections. Maybe another way of saying this whole paradox I'm trying to point out is to say, you got to get over yourself on one level so you can really discover yourself on another. Second principle I put before us, as I move to a conclusion now, is the one that says we affirm and promote the existence of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Among the many paths that bring people to our doors and into this community, sometimes it is one that has involved a spiritual awakening of one kind or another, which has come in the midst of a crisis or a trial. We do have people who come here looking for a place to deal with and to make some sense out of that kind of awakening. I hope we can offer a safe and accepting place for such persons. I'll conclude with this. I recall being at a workshop, one of our District Unitarian Universalist workshops some years ago, where Unitarian Universalists who were recovering alcoholics and some of whom were in 12-step programs were speaking of why they also need
to be a part of a community such as this one, a Unitarian Universalist community. I remember one woman putting it this way. She said, I go to AA on Friday nights to continue my recovery from alcoholism, and then I go to church on Sunday morning to reaffirm and recover my theology. That was pretty nicely put. We come here then for many journeys of the Spirit. As have the new members we have welcomed this morning. People come to us by way of many paths of discovery and meaning. For all of these journeys, I hope we can commit ourselves to offering for all of them a safe and welcoming home. I trust we can hear them and their stories